Well, this hour we'll take your calls with Phil Hall as we talk about Jesus Christ, movie star, Hollywood, and just about everything else you can think of when we come back. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you along with Phil Hall. Phil, with the Patterson-Gimlin film that you've looked at and wrote that book about, what do you think of that? Do you think it was authentic or made up? What's your guess?
Well, in the book itself, The Weirdest Movie Ever Made, I didn't venture to give an opinion because I didn't want the book to be seen as being pro-Bigfoot or anti-Bigfoot. Looking at the film, I'll be honest, I'm somewhat skeptical of it, but I'm not going to come out and say it was a hoax. If it was a hoax, it was an extraordinarily well-done hoax.
Mm-hmm.
And knowing what I know about Mr. Patterson and Mr. Gilman, I, at the risk of being rude, I think that would sort of be beyond their abilities to pull off something that elaborate.
Technically or emotionally?
Both. They didn't strike me particularly. Well, not so much Gimlin. I think he was along for the ride. But Roger Patterson, I don't think he had it in him to create something, certainly a costume, as elaborate as that. One of the things which, why I'm not eager to call it a down-and-out hoax, is because the Sasquatch on screen is obviously a female. It has rather floppy breasts, and a lot of people said, oh, well, this is just a man in a gorilla suit. But gorilla suits that used to be sold back in the 60s for circuses or vaudeville or movies, they were male gorillas. They didn't have floppy breasts the way that the Sasquatch in the film did. So that was a kind of a touch which I don't think Patterson would have been able to pull off.
All right, let's go to the phones. Let's go to Joe in the Bronx. Welcome to the show. Hey, Joseph.
Hey, George. How are you?
Okay, Joe. Thank you.
Good. Phil, my two uncles were depicted in Godfather 2. One of my uncles was a Hollywood prop master. He came up with the horse's head for the scene, one of the top 10 cinematic scenes in Hollywood history.
Great scene.
He procured that horse's head from a New York slaughterhouse, and the blood was really cornstarch.
But that was a real horse head?
It was.
Wow.
Yes.
Okay, I didn't know that.
Now, in Godfather 2, they depict my uncles as the brothers, you know, the dangerous brothers, and I wanted to know, what did you think of that depiction? They also, my uncles also knew Mario Puzo when they were growing up, so I guess that might have helped a little bit. But what did you think about that depiction in Godfather 2? You know, what are your thoughts about the horse's head scene?
Well, the horse's head scene, I think, is one of the iconic scenes in movie history. And also, we should mention that was John Marley was the actor who was in the bed with the horse's head, and his reaction to the film was to the head was obviously what sold it.
And if I recall, Phil, the horse was his racehorse,
correct.
Wasn't it? Yeah,
that is correct.
Okay.
The thing with the Godfather movies, the first Godfather film, Stanley Kubrick said this was the best cast movie of all time, and I have to agree with him. It was a perfectly cast film. Joe, I don't know where you are in the Bronx. I'm originally from the Bronx as well, and so is my family. And my grandmother saw the movie, and the scene where Michael kills Sterling Hayden, it's supposed to be Dominic's restaurant. They didn't film it in Dominic's, but they made the set look just like it. And when she saw the movie, she couldn't stop talking like, oh, my God, they were in Dominic's to film it, because it was just so authentic. I don't know. I'll be honest. It's been a while since I've seen Godfather Part II, so I can't really comment on the characters you're speaking about, but for the first two films in that series, the authenticity was just so strong that anybody who would criticize the films, I think, would be peevish. I'm not a fan of the third movie, which came out many years later, and I think was sort of a travesty, but we could save that for another show.
What did you ever see the movie A Clockwork Orange, Kubrick's?
Oh, yes, many years ago.
That was the weirdest movie, wasn't
yes.
it?
Well, that was Kubrick. He was, by that point in his career, he was just starting to do his own thing, and people didn't stop and say, why are you making these weird movies? He was the rare filmmaker who was able to have his little corner of the industry, get financing, and make these movies, which, in retrospect, They certainly would never be made today. I can't.
No, there's no way people would see those.
I can't even see how Barry Lyndon would be made either. Nobody would make an epic movie in 18th century England and shoot it by candlelight. But that was, Kubrick had that kind of power.
I mean, he did Eyes Wide Shut. At least that made a little more sense.
And it's funny, he made the film in London. He had moved to England in the 1960s and never came back. Eyes Wide Shut takes place entirely in Manhattan. The whole thing was shot in the London studio. In fact, I was actually in London when they were shooting the movie. I was staying in Knightsbridge, and Tom Cruise and Nicole Kidman were at a hotel about two blocks down from me.
And then Kubrick died before the movie ended?
I believe he died either before it ended or right after the production had completed. This was some years ago, so I don't remember the exact details of that, but that was his last film. He was supposed to have made the movie AI, which Steven Spielberg took over.
Let's go to Mike in Texas. Welcome to the show. Hey, Michael.
Hey, George. Hey, Phil. How you doing?
Great.
Pleasure talking to you.
Good morning.
Question for you. Could you talk a little bit about my favorite miniseries based on the life of Jesus, Jesus of Nazareth?
Yes.
It was written by a famous British science fiction writer and a book he wrote. And can you talk a little bit about the actor Robert Powell?
Well, Jesus of Nazareth is not in my book, Jesus Christ Movie Star. As the title would suggest, it's about movie versions of the life of Jesus. Jesus of Nazareth was done for television.
Good music, too.
Good music. Wonderful production. I remember when it came out in 1977, it was very well received, and it's still very well received. The reason I didn't include it in the book or any TV production in the book, because there have been so many productions about the life of Jesus that if I were to try to catalog all of them, even including non-theatrical and educational films, even there are some virtual reality films now about Jesus, I would have a 10-volume set, and so I had to just set very tight parameters. So unfortunately, Jesus of Nazareth is not in the book that I just published, but it is, I believe it's out on DVD and Blu-ray, and if people have never seen it, they really should. It's one of the most mature and intelligent productions, and Robert Powell was a British actor. Americans might know him best as Captain Walker from the movie Tommy. He played Tommy's father, and he wasn't very well known in the U.S. when he was cast as Jesus, and that was a very effective casting because there was an all-star cast in that movie, including Laurence Olivier and Anne Bancroft and Anthony Quinn. It was sort of like
Giants.
The greatest story ever told, because when Max von Sydow was cast as Jesus in 1965 for the movie, he wasn't very well known in the U.S., but the rest of the cast was very well known. Charlton Heston, John Wayne, Sidney Poitier were in the film. So in that sense, the director Zeffirelli took a page from George Stevens in how he put his epic together.
Who would you say was the best Jesus actor?
For me, it was Max von Sydow from Greatest Story Ever Told, because for one thing, he looked like an Eastern Orthodox icon come to life. He was this tall, angular, somewhat severe-looking individual, but there was a sense of otherworldliness about him that other actors never really were able to capture. Some of them just didn't really have it in them. Jeffrey Hunter, for example, in King of Kings, he was just completely miscast, and I think he realized it. And other actors were just playing it more as almost like a zombie, not really being a human. Someone to the other extreme, being too human and not being spiritual, but von Sydow was able to capture both the spirituality as well as the human emotions, particularly towards the end of the film when Jesus is condemned to death.
Next up, let's go to Joe, Long Island, New York. Hello, Joseph.
Hey, Phil. You know what I did at one point? I took three female actors and looked at all the movies I could get online. A lot of them I got on Amazon Prime. One was Kim Novak. She was nothing like she was in Picnic and any of her other movies, which was interesting. Donna Reed was almost nothing like she was in A Wonderful Life. In fact, and from Here to Eternity, I didn't even know it was her. That's how good her acting was. So I wonder what she was like in real life. And then Cecile Laurent, I thought, was amazing, her acting throughout her films. Very impressive. I just remember one scene. It was with gladiators in ancient Rome, and they kind of muffled the sound as she left this gladiator fight, and it really depicted just how insane these people were in that one, like, very long scene as she walked through Rome. And also, the movie The Mission, Jeremy Irons, a scene that made an impression was he had an attraction to a local Indian woman in the remote Amazon, and he's beating himself up for it. And I'm thinking, any friend in that location of any gender would be desirable. Like, well, that was interesting to me, that movie, The Mission.
Well, yes, The Mission, it's an interesting film. And I think one of the problems in making films with religious themes is that how do you depict the character's inner conflict and trying to come to terms with the divine within a profane world. I mean, watching Jeremy Irons beat himself up for having carnal thoughts, we might look at it as being a bit strange, but we have to put ourselves into the context of the film and into what a character like his would be going through at that time, and it would make sense. It's a wonderful film. It doesn't get a lot of attention today. It was a very big hit when it came out. It was nominated for Best Picture. But today is one of those films that, for whatever reason, has fallen through the cracks. But I'm glad that you mentioned also Sophia Loren, Donna Reed, and Kim Novak. They were all great stars, but they were also great actresses and great performers. They knew their craft. Their films stand the test of time. Donna Reed's TV show, of course, was a long-running success as well. And she was a lot more versatile than people give her credit for. You're right, with From Here to Eternity, she wasn't supposed to be cast in the movie. Fred Zinnemann didn't really want her to play that part, but she was under contract at Columbia Pictures, and he was sort of forced to work with her, and it turned out to be the best thing because she won the Oscar for that performance.
Well, how would you categorize Alfred Hitchcock as a director?
Oh, well... Some people won't like me for saying this, but Hitchcock is really hit and miss for me.
Really?
There are some great classics, obviously, but there are also a lot of films that are just sort of eh. They sit there. They don't really work. We remember the classics. And
Psycho.
Psycho, of course. Rear Window, Lifeboat.
The Birds.
Yeah, but then you also have films like Rope and Under Capricorn and Torn Curtain, and even going back to the films he made in the early 1930s in England, they're more interesting than invigorating. But Hitchcock was never a bore, and I like Hitchcock. I don't love Hitchcock. But that's the thing with movies. When somebody says, oh, this is the be-all, end-all of movies, that's an opinion. Everybody who talks about movies is discussing an opinion. There are people who don't like The Godfather. There are people who don't like Citizen Kane. There are people who don't like Hitchcock. But, you know, that's that old saying about opinions. I'll clean it up for radio, is that everybody has one, and it's like a lower body cavity. Everybody has one, and most of them stink, and that's what opinions are.
Do you remember his TV show, Hitchcock's?
Oh, I remember from reruns. I'm not old enough to recall it, to have seen it first time round, but I have seen the reruns of it, and they're on YouTube as well. So people who have never seen Alfred Hitchcock Presents, they're very good. He didn't direct most of the episodes. He did mostly the introductions, but there were some episodes that he was behind the camera.
Let's go to Walt in Pennsylvania. Hey, Walter, go ahead.
Hi, George, as usual. Sorry, it's great to be on with you, George.
Thanks, Walt.
George, and Mr. Hall, you're terrific. You're very knowledgeable. I think the greatest compliment I could pay is that you are to biblical epics what Mr. Lobo is to science fiction. So you know your stuff.
Thank you, sir.
Well, I grew up, as George did, watching these great biblical epics. And I remember seeing 1959's Ben-Hur for the first time at a drive-in. And, what struck me at eight years old, I was, needless to say, very naive. And, I was a believer back then. But in the prologue to Ben-Hur, as you recall, when they play the great overture music, it describes the movie as a tale of the Christ. And that was struck me at 8 years old. That was, you might say, that was the beginning of my atheism, agnosticism, when I saw it, the movie described as a tale, a tale or a story of the Christ, where At 8 years old, I was in my naivety. I thought that I was actually watching history on the screen.
And, well, look, and how lucky you were to have been able to see Ben-Hur on the big screen, even the drive-in screen. That was must have been a wonderful experience. Ben-Hur is interesting, not only the 1959 film, but the original 1926 silent movie, because Jesus is not really seen on the screen. We see his hand outstretched on the screen. We see the back of his head, but we don't actually see his face and we don't hear his voice. And it was particularly strange in the 1959 film because they had hired a well-known opera singer to play Jesus on screen, but they didn't use his voice, and they didn't show him on the screen. So they could have just chosen anybody from Central Casting or the Screen Extras Guild, but instead they went out of their way to get somebody who was prominent and didn't bother to put him on camera.
Did anything ever happen mystically, Phil, at any of these films of Jesus? Anything strange?
Well, I think the strangest thing I mentioned earlier in our interview was the filming of Barabbas. The crucifixion scene, there was an eclipse that took place. And in the New Testament, there is the sky goes dark after Jesus dies on the cross. So as luck would have it, when they were filming Barabbas, the sky did go dark, and it wasn't a special effect.
Let's go to Craig, Hollywood, California, west of the Rockies, obviously. Hey, Craig, go ahead.
Hey, George, how you doing?
Okay, thank you.
You know who I am, don't you?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Phil, I'm going to bring you way back to 1915, 1916. My great uncle played in Civilization as Jesus.
Really?
And, yes.
Oh, my goodness.
And
wow.
George, his name was George Fisher, and he worked for Thomas Harper Ince.
Oh, my goodness. I am impressed. That is,
Small world.
Small world. Civilization is a very important movie in the history of Jesus cinema because Jesus was taken out of the New Testament setting and put into a contemporary setting. Civilization is a pacifist movie which was made to encourage America not to go into World War I. And Jesus actually interacted with contemporary figures in that movie that had not been done before in American cinema. Did your great uncle have any anecdotes that he shared with the family on the making of the film?
No, he didn't. And what it was, I moved to Hollywood to become an actor, and then learned that he subsequently was my great uncle. And then I learned about Thomas Harper Ince, but he passed away in 1960, and My grandmother and my great-grandmother, which was her brother-in-law, they were all involved with Sears back in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, and they say he was a great guy, you know, and he was a pacifist. So he really, it's really a cool movie to see and then to find out you're related to him, you know.
Oh, that is great. We're going to take a quick break here, Phil, and come back and take some final calls with you in just a moment. The name of the book we're talking about tonight, Jesus Christ, Movie Star, available, of course, all over the place. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM and take final phone calls with you. And also don't forget to check out our website, Coast to Coast AM Official. And we've got all the latest information you need anytime you want just by going to coasttocoastam.com. Webmasters put some great information up there for you. On our next Coast to Coast program, we'll talk about miracles, and then a psychic to the stars joins us, Michelle Whitedove, so I'm looking forward to that. And welcome back to Coast, our special guest Phil Hall with us. Phil, how did you get interested in cinema and theater?
Well, I was always interested in that ever since I was a little boy. Like any child, I used to watch movies on television, loved cartoons. Originally, I wanted to be an animator, like Chuck Jones, except I wasn't very talented when it came to drawing. But as I went to college, I wanted a journalism career. And when I was in college, I was able to get a gig as the film critic on my campus newspaper. And I used that as the springboard, which got me freelance writing work with the New York Daily News. And The rest, as they say, is history.
Super. Let's go to the phones. Jim in Newark, Delaware. Welcome to the program, Jim. Hi there. Nope. Jim is not there.
Oh.
Okay. Let's try Rich in San Francisco. Hey, Rich, go ahead.
Yes. Yes. Am I on?
Yes, you are.
Oh, thank you. Yes. I was wondering, you mentioned a movie that was on network TV, and it was a while back. Wasn't there a Life of Jesus that starred this guy who played the life of the composer Gustav Mahler? I can't remember what his name is. Did you give that name, or is that some other movie?
That might be some other movie. I don't know if you're mentioning Max von Sydow, the Swedish actor, but he played Jesus. I'm not certain if he played Mahler in a movie.
Well, this fellow played the life of the composer Gustav Mahler, and he's an English actor.
Oh, Robert Powell. Is that who you're referring to?
What was the name?
Robert Powell. He was in Jesus of Nazareth, the TV miniseries.
Maybe that's it. I don't know. Robert Howell.
Powell.
Powell. Powell.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Well, I thought that was a pretty good one, and I also think that the concept Christ doesn't really belong because it's in conflict with the historic Jesus. So the title should have been Jesus, not Jesus Christ, because that would be blasphemous to the heritage he was raised in, you know.
The beautiful thing about this genre is that there is an endless number of interpretations of who Jesus was and what he was capable of doing and what his mission is. We have very profound and sincere movies. And quite frankly, we also have movies that are very flippant and some people might consider insulting. I think one of the strangest movies was made in Detroit in 1971. It was originally called The Greatest Story Overtold, and it was later released as The Divine Mr. J. And the only reason people remember the movie today is because Bette Midler is in the movie. She made it at the beginning of her career. She, in 1971, nobody knew who she was, and she played the Virgin Mary. She's on screen for about 10 minutes. When the film was released in 1974, she was already a big star at that time, and she sued to have the movie taken out of theaters, and she was successful.
Really?
Yes. One of the reasons she did that is because they used the poster art from her album, The Divine Miss M, for the advertising, and they didn't have permission to use it. So her lawyers were able to get the film withdrawn for that. Years later, they tried to put it out on home video under another title called The Thorn, and
they
used her image in the advertising for that. And again, her lawyers were able to get the film withdrawn from release. The movie's on YouTube under the title of The Thorn. If anybody wants to see a very bad movie, or see Bette Midler at the beginning of her career before she was famous, go on YouTube and look for The Thorn Bette Midler, and you'll find it.
Bob in Pennsylvania, first-time caller. Hello, Bob. Go ahead.
Hi, George and Phil. Nice to talk to you finally.
Thank you, sir.
Not to get off topic, but on movie subjects, I was referring back to a movie in the late 80s or 90s called The Game with Michael Douglas. Are you familiar with it?
Great movie.
I vaguely remember the film. That was from a long time ago, yes.
I just liked it due to the fact that it was one of the few movies that I can remember that you actually didn't suspect the ending at all. It kept you really thinking throughout the whole thing, and when you thought you had to figure it out, it totally changed right up to the very last minute. And today's writing doesn't even seem to touch anywhere near to the depth that that did, and it seemed to go really very fluid, flawlessly done, and especially with, like, Sean Penn and very limited actors, just did, I think, a phenomenal job with it.
It was a great movie.
And like with Alexa today spying on you supposedly and things of that effect, it just shows you how things, rather than a few keystrokes, how your life can change today, how it could have been done then with this a group of actors, how they could change your life. I just thought it was a very well done movie.
Isn't it interesting too how great actors like Kirk Douglas have offspring like Michael Douglas, who do well, Kiefer Sutherland and his father, Donald?
Indeed. And actually, Donald Sutherland played Jesus in a movie called Johnny Got His Gun.
Oh, did he?
Yes. That was made in 1971 by Dalton Trumbo. And Some of the older listeners might remember Dalton Trumbo from being one of the Hollywood Ten, and that was one of his first.
He was blacklisted.
That's right, and he overcame the blacklist.
Thanks to Kirk Douglas and Spartacus, right?
That's right. Yeah, it's funny how you think movie industry is such a wide industry. Actually, it seems a lot smaller than we might imagine.
Yep, absolutely. What did you think of that whole blacklisting of the time?
Oh,
was it paranoid?
It was a tragic time in our country's history, and I'm afraid it's going to get repeated if certain people are really not allowed to engage in their free political thought. I mean, that's the beauty of this country, is that you can think the way you want to think and have the right to express yourself, but to be censored or not to be able to be given work or what we now call cancel culture, I think that's the worst possible thing, and it's totally antithetical to everything this country stands for.
I think you're right, but I felt sorry for a lot of those people. I remember Burgess Meredith. Remember him, the great actor?
Yeah. Great actor.
Talking about how Zero Mostel got blacklisted, too.
Oh, there were many people. Actually, Pert Kelton, who was the first Alice Cramden with Jackie Gleason, was blacklisted as well. She would have gone on to the Honeymooners series, but CBS wouldn't hire her because she was listed in red channels as being a communist, which she was not. But
most of them weren't.
No, they weren't, and that was the great tragedy. And you know, even if they were not a threat to the American security. And we look back today at those who were blacklisted, particularly someone like Paul Robeson is considered to be a cultural icon. But in the 1950s, you couldn't say his name on television or give him any space in the newspapers.
He was a great actor.
And a great singer, too.
Yep, yep. Jim in Delaware, back again, Jim. Gotcha.
Hey, George, where's Cornelius on this subject?
I don't know, but he checked in with us a couple days ago. He seems fine.
Yeah, I'm glad he is fine.
Me too.
Anyway, I have a Christian music station on the Internet, so I'm interested in this. But the movie I never saw, and I thought it was a spoof on the life of Christ, called The Life of Brian.
Monty Python, yes. It's not a spoof on the life of Christ. They originally said they were going to do a comedy on the life of Jesus as a joke, and they didn't follow through with it. Life of Brian is more of a historic spoof than a specific biblical spoof. If you like Monty Python, it's a very funny movie. Jesus is in the film very, very briefly, first as an infant in a nativity scene, and then the Sermon on the Mount. But the actor who plays him is seen at a great distance, and Jesus' name isn't really mentioned in much of the film. That was the first movie to get a lot of protests outside of theaters, where people thought it was being blasphemous and sacrilegious. And Terry Gilliam, who's one of the Monty Python members, later said he thought they should be thanked for it, because this was the first time that Catholics, Protestants, and Jews were able to unite in
a common cause. Yeah. Joey in Los Angeles. Hey, Joey, go ahead.
Hi, George and Phil. I was just wondering, when you brought up Stanley Kubrick before, there's been this guest, like an expert on it, on Coast to Coast a couple of times on him, and he claimed that the widow in France, I believe, is on video somewhere saying she thinks that her husband was murdered. Do you know any more about that?
About Stanley Kubrick? I'm not aware of that. That's the first I've heard of that.
Yeah, that was a story that the wife had thought that, but who knows? I don't know how he died. How do you?
I don't recall the circumstances of his death, but I've never heard of the story that it was a hit job.
Next up, thanks, Joey. Let's go to Ed in Sierra Madre, California, west of the Rockies. Hello, Ed. Go ahead.
Thanks, George.
Thank you, sir.
Mr. Hall, I have four films. I know that's not fair, but I'd like to mention their names and get your feeling about them. Two of them involve highly left political directors who allow the so-called villains of the film to make some pretty convincing arguments in favor. And I'm talking about A Few Good Men and 3 Days of the Condor.
Oh, yes.
And then there was a film from my youth that scared the pants off me. I was barely 12 years old, and it was the portrait of Dorian, a picture of Dorian Gray. And by the way, Donna Reed had a role in that movie. I realize that now. I didn't know that then. And then the final one is Cool Hand Luke. And
these
the
are
famous
all classic films, yeah.
What we've got here is Failure to Communicate.
Yes. They're all wonderful movies. 3 Days of the Condor was that's a film that really needs to be seen again. It was shot in 1975 in New York City. Picture of Dorian Gray, that turns up on the Turner Classic Movie Channel, if any of your listeners are subscribers. It's a wonderful film, mostly black and white, but the picture itself is in Technicolor, and your caller is correct. It could scare the pants off of you. And, I mean, so much has been said about Cool Hand Luke, I really couldn't possibly add anything new to the conversation.
Kubrick had just completed Eyes Wide Shut and died of a heart attack in his sleep.
Okay. Yeah, that's why I never heard anything about him being killed. That was I do remember that the film was that he had died after the film was completed. I think it had already been released. There was some controversy because Warner Brothers decided to use some sort of shadowing on some of the scenes because they felt it was a little too risque.
Let's go to Sherry in Kentucky, first-time caller. Hi, Cher. Go ahead.
Hey, George. How are you?
Okay. Thank you.
I just want to first just to wish you a happy belated birthday and your mother, too.
Well, thank you.
And to tell you how much I enjoy the show, and I really respect your opinion when I hear it. So I just keep doing what you're doing, and I enjoy it very much.
We will.
My question, I was wanting to know what your opinion was. Movie that Jim Caviezel,
Passion of the Christ.
Passion of the Christ. Yes. Wow, we saved it. We saved that one for the end. That was actually the last movie that I watched in doing the research for the book. I didn't see the film when it came out. There was a lot of controversy about it, and then there was controversy about Mel Gibson's behavior outside of the film, which sort of turned me off to it. When I finally saw the film, I was surprised. It was not. This sounds snobbish. It's not as bad as I was afraid it was going to be, because this is a movie which really shows the torture of Jesus at a greater depth than other films had, in terms of scourging and the crucifixion. I thought Jim did a wonderful job in the film as Jesus.
I do, too. He was a good actor.
He's a wonderful actor. And going back to what I mentioned earlier about cancel culture, he doesn't really get the roles that he should be getting. And he said a lot of it is because of his political advocacy, which doesn't fit with what a lot of the Hollywood elite are advocating. If that's the case, it's a real shame, because Jim is a wonderful actor. It's an interesting film. It's a very idiosyncratic film. It takes some liberties with the story. There are some special effects, which I personally don't think belonged in the movie, but it deserves to be seen. And the fact that Mel Gibson was able to get it made on his own, I think, is a testament to his spirit, and the fact that he wanted to show his version of what he felt the life of Jesus was. And that's the beauty of the subject, because there is no definitive movie about the life of Jesus. There has been countless number of depictions, from the sacred to the profane. And as I said earlier, films are still being made on the subject, so it's a world without end.
Phil, do you think those big-budget Hollywood films are kapush?
Oh, well, big-budget films are still being made, and the budgets are bigger than ever. Whether there'll be another biblical epic of the Cecil B. DeMille school, probably not. But movie-making is very, very expensive today. Hundreds of millions of dollars are going into these films. So I don't think there's going to be any threat to epics. I think the threat's going to be maybe to smaller films. I don't think they're going to be able to get much screen time, because people are going to be accustomed to seeing the big-budget epics, and the little films maybe come out at the end of the year to qualify for the Oscar, and that's it.
And, Phil, where do people get Jesus Christ Movie Star?
You can get it on Amazon. You could get it at any of the e-commerce sites. My publisher is Bear Manna Media. You can get it from their website. It was just published on June 7th, so it's brand new. Go out and get it.
Super. Phil, thanks for being on the program. You take care of yourself. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasseur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Burrows, Tim Banal, George Knapp, and Ian Punnett, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.